Faith, the Essence of the Gospel, was presented by Peter Wieringa on May 28, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
Well, good morning, everybody.
And I just got to tell you that the last several years for me have been a fascinating journey in helping me to focus and to understand and to clarify more just what it is I believe and how that is similar and different from what other people believe. And let me just go back and recount to you a little bit of my history, a little bit of my experience. Back in 1977, and some of you have heard this already, some of you know this, back in 1977, I was finishing my graduate program at UC Santa Barbara and was looking at going to seminary because I wanted to be a Bible teacher. That was my desire. That was my goal. And I looked at seminaries all over the country and looked at different opportunities and ran across this bunch, this group of people up in Palo Alto at Peninsula Bible Church. There was a program up there called Scribe School, which was a two-year, basically a seminary program, a house seminary program. And what was interesting to me, given what I had been learning and understanding while I was in college, what was interesting to me was how it was similar to and different in some respects from some of the seminary programs I was looking at. One of the seminary programs that was and is to this day one of the most influential seminary programs in the country was a program that I had looked at real seriously. But I remember back then hearing that in order to get into the seminary, you needed to be able to adhere to and sign a statement of faith. And in order to get out of the seminary, you also needed to be able to sign the same statement of faith. Now, I remember that from 20 plus years ago, almost 30 years ago now, but I had come to think that I had dreamt that because that sounded so outrageous. But it turns out I was talking with a friend just a couple weeks ago who had a brother who went to the same seminary recently, and that is, to this day, that is the case. Well, that to me seemed odd for one simple reason, and that is because I was not looking for a school that would tell me what to believe. I wasn't looking for a school that would hand me a package of theological positions and positions that I had to agree with before I got in and that I would agree with after I got out. My thought was, well, what's the point of seminary then? I mean, why am I there if they're simply handing me what it is I'm supposed to believe? So I ended up going off to this little scribe school program in Palo Alto, California. And at scribe school, now this is where you folks get real familiar with this story. Jack Crabtree was one of my teachers there. Some of you folks have heard of David Roper. Bud Ortland was one of the teachers there. Dave Smith, I don't see Dave right handy, but Dave Smith was one of the teachers there. Dave and Kay were in the program before I was. And I said this a couple weeks ago, or a couple months ago when I taught. Kay was by far the smartest person in the whole program. I just want you to know that. No question about it. Kay was head and shoulders above the rest of us in the academics there. But Dave ended up being one of the teachers there, discipled me for a year that I was in scribe school. Some of my classmates while I was at scribe school were folks like the infamous Ron Julian. Larry Barber was one of my classmates there. Bob Blanchard was one of my classmates there. I don't think there's anybody else that's here that was in our class, but it was just an outstanding experience. And for then the next 25 years after that, when I had to explain to somebody what that experience was all about, I struggled trying to figure out how to explain it. But the best I could come up with, the best explanation I could give, was that at scribe school, they didn't tell us what to believe. They didn't tell us what the scriptures had to say. They taught us to study the scriptures for ourselves. And for me, that made all the difference in the world, because all around me were people who had preconceived ideas of just what the scriptures had to say, usually tied up in a nice, neat package for everybody to admire. But it didn't fit with my experience of having to grapple with, wrestle with the scriptures for myself. And over the last couple of months, this has really been coming into focus more and more for me. A couple of weeks ago, Jack talked about, here on Sunday morning, he talked about the whole issue of whether or not we believe creeds and traditions and things that have always been taught, or whether or not we grapple with what the scriptures have to say. Well, I've been struggling with that for many, many years myself. And I remember back 5-6 years ago, actually 6-7 years ago now, while we still lived in Boise, there was a small group of people that were getting together to form a church. And there was a raging discussion that was going on as we were discussing exactly what the church would look like and exactly what how we would form up. And part of the discussion centered around the whole question of a statement of faith. And there were some of us who wanted to have our statement of faith as simple as, this is it. This is what we believe in. We ended up struggling with a one-page document, trying to come up with something fairly simple, fairly straightforward. But there were a couple of men who were key leaders in this little group, who were some of the key people helping get things started, who were insistent that included in the statement of faith had to be a reference to and a claim that we would adhere to the Westminster Confessions, and I don't even remember the exact name, the London Baptist Confession. I don't know if any of the rest of you know what that's all about, but anyway, there were several different creeds and formulations that they insisted we needed to have included in our statement of faith. And some of us were saying, well, this just doesn't seem to fit. Do we adhere to what the scriptures have to say and thus deny what creeds and confessions have to say to the degree that they differ from what the scriptures have to say? Or do we let those creeds and confessions dictate what we think that the scriptures have to say? That's exactly what Jack was talking about a couple weeks ago. Well, as we're going through all that, our kids are coming to school over here at Gutenberg, and we are visiting over here all the time, stopping in at Reformation Fellowship, renewing old acquaintances with folks that we'd known from years before. And as I would try to describe what our experience was here in Eugene, I had a hard time putting it into words, because what I would say would be something like, and you folks have probably struggled with this yourself, I would say something like, well, the folks over there really believe and teach what the scriptures have to say. Well, does that sound stupid or what? I mean, what's somebody else going to say? Well, I don't really believe and teach what the... I mean, that what's somebody going to say to something like that? It's hard to really describe and hard to have people really understand what that means. But what I would suggest for those of you who have been a part of this group for a long time, what I would suggest is that you perhaps don't really know what's going on in much of the church out there. And I'm not going to say the whole church, but I am going to say that much of the church is intent on managing and controlling people's understanding of what the scriptures have to say by reducing it to detailed statements of faith. It just cracks me up when there was one time that I applied for a position to pastor a church, and I got back from them a statement of faith that I needed to adhere to, and there were, it was a lengthy, several-page statement of faith, and each line in the statement of faith would have four, five, or six scripture references attached to it as supporting evidence of what these particular points were in the statement of faith. Well, I couldn't even begin to sign something like that because it would take me a lifetime to review every point of the statement of faith and to review every passage of scripture to make sure that those passages of scripture actually said what the statement of faith said that they were saying. Well, what I'm going to suggest is that much of the church today really has worked hard at trying to make Christianity more, I don't know what word to use other than more manageable, by reducing it to statements of faith, reducing it to creeds and to traditions. And a big part of that that is going to happen virtually in every case, a big part of that is that that reduction of the faith, that managing of the faith, is going to result in management of people's behaviors as well and expectations about just what it's going to look like in the life of other people if, in fact, they're Christians. Well, again, if you've been around here for a while, you folks don't know perhaps how good you have it with the teaching that you receive here from Ron and Jack and David and others that that teach up here. You don't know how good you have it because what they're doing, what they're wrestling with and struggling with is trying to help us understand plainly and simply what the gospel is all about and what the scriptures teach, not with a bunch of things added on in terms of formulations and in terms of dogma and additional things that are added on, but struggling with just exactly what the faith is all about, what Christianity is all about. And what I wanted to do this morning was take just a minute just to remind you, there probably isn't much of anything that I'll say this morning that is real new to you, but what I wanted to do was to remind you of what I think the scriptures have always taught. That's for me one of the fascinating things about this community and what's taught here and about what I'm going to talk about this morning, and that is what we're trying to do is not teach something new and different. What we're in fact trying to do is teach what has always been taught. And that, again, is very hard for some people to understand. I don't know how many times you have perhaps yourself experienced or you have heard someone else express that when they get exposed to some of the teaching at McKenzie Study Center, at Reformation Fellowship, at Gutenberg, when they get exposed to some of that teaching, they'll express things like, I've never heard this before. Where did this come from? This is new to me. Well, it isn't new. So that's what I think is critical to understand, is that what is taught around here is not new. It's not something that is intended to be fresh and exciting. Rather, it is a recounting of the message that has always been there. It's a recounting of the gospel as it has always been proclaimed. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. And for me, it's helpful to look at the scriptures and have some places in the scriptures that I can hang some of those thoughts on. And that's what I wanted to try to do this morning, just to give you some places that you can go to in the scriptures to understand what we're talking about. And then also what I'm going to do is go back and look at several examples in the Old Testament that in my mind are real life examples, expressions of what the gospel is all about. So what I wanted to communicate several things. First of all, just some of my presuppositions that I'm starting with before we jump into things. Basic presupposition that I want to give to you is that the gospel, when we talk about the gospel, when I talk about the gospel, what I'm talking about is that which is the good news. That's simply what the word means in Greek. It's that which is the good news about what God has done about the human condition, about human sinfulness. It's what God has done to deal with human sinfulness. That's in my mind just the nutshell expression of what the gospel is all about. Another presupposition I'm starting with is that God has always have the same understanding of what the gospel is all about. God didn't have, here's plan A about how to deal with human sinfulness and the human condition, and then when that doesn't work, here's plan B. That isn't the case. God has always, from day one, dealt with sin and the human condition in the same way. And that's what I'm going to try to illustrate a little bit later when we look at the Old Testament, is that from the very beginning, God has always intended that sin and the human condition be dealt with the same way. Another presupposition that I want to throw out there is that God communicates and has always communicated that message, that gospel, from the very beginning. And there are a couple of passages that are striking in their clarity in that regard. In Romans chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, Paul introduces the letter to the church at Rome by saying, Paul, a bondservant of Christ Jesus, called as an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures concerning his Son. But all Paul's doing in introducing his letter to the Romans is saying that this gospel is something that God has promised a long time ago and has always been a part of his plan. He didn't switch to plan B when Jesus came along and plan A didn't work. Rather, God has always had the same plan, the same idea in mind. Then in Hebrews 1, verses 1 to 2, and I'm going to betray my understanding here. I think that Paul wrote Hebrews. There's not universal acceptance of that idea by any means. A lot of other ideas about who wrote Hebrews. I happen to think that Paul wrote Hebrews. In the introduction to Hebrews, Hebrews 1, verses 1 to 2, Paul, I would suggest, says, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days he has spoken to us in his Son. Same idea. The idea is that God has from the very beginning desired to communicate and give us the opportunity to hear and to understand what the gospel is all about, what his intention is in dealing with the human condition, dealing with sin. Well, then, stating the obvious, the gospel is realized in the life of the believer when that individual has faith. Faith is what is just the key component of what the gospel is all about. I would suggest that the word faith in the New Testament could just as easily, in most cases, be expressed or be translated belief. And I don't want to give the wrong impression about that. We'll look at this in a minute in Hebrews 11. It isn't simply an intellectual assent. When I talk about faith or belief, it isn't simply just an intellectual agreement with a stated proposition. Rather, it is an agreement that results in a change of heart, that results in a change of behavior, change of attitudes. It results in us thinking and acting and speaking differently than we did before. So it isn't simply an intellectual exercise, belief or faith. Rather, it is a change that goes down to the very core of who we are and results in there being a difference in our lives. Well, faith is what the gospel is all about. And then the other thing that I want to state that should be obvious, but I got to make it really, really clear, and that is what the gospel is all about is what God does. It is not about what we do. It is not about the role that we have, the part that we play in the whole thing. What the gospel is all about is what God does on our behalf. And I might have even told this story several months ago when I taught before. When I was in high school, I grew up in the Jesus movement in Southern California. And when I first realized that I was really starting to think something a little bit different than the Christian culture that was around me at the time, this is in the late 60s, early 70s in Southern California, when I first realized that I was thinking something a little bit differently was when I woke up to the music of the Jesus movement, and it seemed to be so thoroughly centered on me, so thoroughly centered on what God has done for me or what I'm supposed to do or what my response is. It seemed to focus so much on the human individual rather than focusing on God. And at that point, I can remember very distinctly, it was one of those moments of clarity. I can remember where I was walking, what I was doing when I realized this is not what the gospel is all about. It is not about me. The gospel is all about God and about what God has done, about who he is. Well, let me just have us turn to Hebrews 11 here for a little bit, and I'm going to flip through Hebrews 11 for a little while, and then we're going to go to the Old Testament, look at several passages in the Old Testament. Hebrews 11 is a passage that is just full of outstanding accounts and very interesting insights into what faith is all about, starting with the first verse of the chapter, going all the way through. It just shakes up your understanding of what faith is all about when you read through Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 starts off like this in verse 1. Paul says, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." And that, for me, was the first thing that was striking. And the thing that strikes me about faith in every respect is it's unexpected. It isn't exactly what we think that it is in many cases. Faith is not sort of a wishful thinking. And again, Jack talked about this just in the last couple of weeks. It isn't just sort of a wishful thinking. Rather, faith is a confident expectation of, bottom line, what God has said he is about the job of doing. So that's what the writer of Hebrews says here. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Then he goes on and he says, "For by it the men of old gained approval." And when I looked at that many, many years ago, that struck me that what Paul was saying in this passage is God has always asked people to respond in faith. He did not in the Old Testament ask people to respond by keeping the law and by becoming righteous or being considered righteous by virtue of the fact that they kept the law. That has never been God's way of doing things. From the very beginning, God has dealt with humanity and dealt with this problem of sin and with the human condition on the basis of faith, on the basis of one's believing response to what God says and to who God is. Well, then he goes on and he says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible." This is an aside. This isn't even necessarily the main point of verse 3, but what struck me about this verse and about the early chapters in Romans is that God has given to humanity enough of a picture, enough of an understanding of who he is in the created order to give humanity something to respond to in faith. And that, to me, is a remarkable thought as well, because there are people more and more who try to narrow down exactly what it means to respond by faith. And for people, for folks in many churches, it has to look a certain way. There have to be certain words that are spoken. There have to be certain theological tenets that are adhered to for one to truly be considered a Christian. And what I see in this passage and what I see throughout the Old Testament is that God calls those whom he chooses to call, and they respond in faith to whatever understanding they have, and that is what God considers in them to be righteousness, that response of faith. Well, then going on, and I'm going to jump down to verse 6 here, because this is for me a sort of a capsule understanding of what faith is all about. In verse 6, it says, "Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that," and I'm going to suggest there are two things here, "must believe that God is, and must believe that God is a rewarder of those who have faith in him." And that, for me, really helps to simplify this whole business of what it means to have faith. It starts off most basically, most fundamentally, with a belief that God is. That's what the beginning of faith is all about. You got to believe that God is. And then beyond that, there's a response to faith, and that is believing that he, or a response of faith, I would suggest, and that is believing that he is a rewarder of those who have faith in him. Well, in my mind, that expresses simply the idea that faith will dictate for us, in us, from the inside out, will dictate for us a change in who we are. We will seek him, we will pursue him, because of our understanding that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. So again, I don't want to get the two mixed up. It is not that we do certain things that command God to show his favor to us or to consider us righteousness. That's not it at all. It starts off with simply a belief that God is, and then from that comes a response of pursuing him and of seeking him. Well, then as you go down through through Romans chapter 11, there are several examples of what this is all about, what this looks like. In the life of believers in the Old Testament, there's one other note that I want to make before we look at some of those examples, and that note comes out of Hebrews 11, verse 13, because we need to understand that faith is not for the faint of heart. Faith is not for those who want and expect and demand some result, some positive result here and now. Our culture is shot through with the expectation that if we do certain things, we will get certain positive results that will come of that. But what Paul says here in Hebrews 11, verse 13, he goes through and he begins to list some of the Old Testament characters who responded to God by faith. And then in verse 13, he says, all of these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. And that's an important thing for us to understand as we seek to understand what faith is all about in our life. If we're expecting that faith is going to result in our problems being solved now, in the answers that we want to the predicaments of life right here and now, if we're going to demand that of God, if we're going to, as some people talk about it, stand on the promises and expect that God will respond a certain way, we're going to be disappointed, because the scriptures are full of examples. Our lives, I would suggest, are full of examples of what it means to have faith and still be waiting to see just exactly how God's going to respond to that. That doesn't mean that God is not God. That doesn't mean that he isn't powerful. That doesn't mean he isn't loving. But what it does mean is that God has a picture, a story, to use Jack's illustration from his book. He has a story that is different from and other than our expectations, other than what we perhaps would demand. Well, that's important for us to understand as we think about faith. And the other thing out of Hebrews 12, verse 2, just to mention in passing, is Hebrews 12, verse 2 refers to Jesus as the author and perfecter of our faith. And that's, I think, an important point for us to understand as well. We don't somehow or other conjure up faith within ourselves. It is God who is, in fact, the author and the perfecter of our faith. He is the one who gives us faith. He is the one who enlarges our faith, if you will. He is the one who gives us the opportunity and the ability to respond in faith. God is the one who is behind even the faith that we have. Well, let's look at some Old Testament stories here to illustrate this. And the reason I give you these Old Testament accounts is because for me, it is really helpful to see God's been doing this the same way from day one. God has been, from the very beginning, going all the way back to the garden, God has been asking individuals to respond in faith, to respond in belief that he is and that he's doing something, that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. Well, going back in Genesis 3, verse 15, and some of these are kind of quirky stories, if you will, and there are probably some different interpretations for these things than I'm going to suggest to you, but these are some passages and some interpretations that have made a lot of sense to me over the years. In Genesis 3, if you look at verse 15, that's the account of where Adam and Eve have sinned, and then God goes about pronouncing a curse on all of the participants in the sin. And in chapter 3, verse 15, God is pronouncing a curse upon the serpent. And he says in 3 verse 15, he says, with Adam and Eve listening in, I believe, I mean, they must have been there listening in on this. He says, I will put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman, Eve, and between your seed and her seed. Now let me go off on a side trail here. Whenever you look at the scriptures, and it's going to be everything from the accounts in Genesis, Exodus, the accounts in Romans, Galatians, New Testament, Old Testament accounts, whenever you look at the scriptures, whenever there is discussion about the descendants or the seed, perk your ears up a little bit, pay a little bit more attention to what's being talked about there, because going all the way back to the garden here, there's a discussion of what is going to be going on, the ongoing relationship of struggle between the seed or the descendants of the woman and the serpent. And that's what is started here in 3 verse 15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed or descendants and her seed, singular. He shall crush your head. There's a change there. And what God is telling the serpent is there is an individual coming who is going to crush the head of the serpent. He shall crush your head, and you, the serpent, will bruise him on the heel. Well, we come to understand from our understanding of what the scriptures have to say that that's a reference to Jesus. What Adam and Eve are hearing and what the serpent is being told is that there is coming a descendant of Eve who is going to crush the serpent, who is going to put to rest and lay to rest the problem of sin in the world. Well, what to me then is remarkable is not so much that promise as much as it is what goes on in chapter 4, verse 1. And I'm not an Old Testament Hebrew expert by any means. I'm relying on the marginal notes from the New American Standard for this. But if you've got the New American Standard, very interesting way of translating Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. Where Genesis says, now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have gotten a man child. And if you look at the New American Standard, you have then in italics, with the help of the Lord. Well, the New American Standard marginal note gives us an alternate translation that in my mind makes a lot more sense of what's going on here. When it reads, behold, I have gotten a man, that is the Lord. Well, to put it simply, I think that what Eve was expecting was that, and I just have to laugh when I think of this picture, because Eve's having a baby. Nobody's ever had a baby before. She doesn't know quite what's going on here. So this is all kind of new to her. She's trying to figure this out as she goes through it here. But she has this child. She has heard God tell the serpent that she will have a descendant who is going to crush the head of the serpent. It's her understanding, just simply by her own experience and by thinking it through reasonably, that she wasn't able to crush the head of the serpent. She wasn't able to live up to the temptation. Adam wasn't able to. And so her expectation when she gives birth to this child is that she has given birth to the Lord. That's my reading of, that's my take on this passage. And that to me then makes just a lot more sense of what God is doing in revealing something of himself and something of his plan and what it was like in this case for Eve to respond in faith. Eve's response, God said that one of her descendants will crush the serpent. Eve's response when Cain was born was, I guess this is it. Behold, I've begotten a man, or I've gotten a man, that is the Lord. Well, that to me was an example of the fact that going all the way back to the garden, all the way back to the beginning of history, that is what God has had in mind from the very beginning, a communication of the fact that he has a plan, he has a purpose, he has an individual in mind who is going to take care of the problem of human sin. That's the gospel. Well, then jumping down into Genesis a little bit further, we move on, and there are countless examples of this sort of thing throughout the Old Testament. We're just going to look at a couple of them. in Genesis a little bit later, Genesis 12, we see the example of Abram at that point as God is calling Abram. Abram is promised by God. God promises to him that he would have descendants, that is seed. He would have descendants through whom all the families of the earth shall be blessed, it says in Genesis 12, verse 3. Now, in my mind, this is most directly a reference to Jesus coming. That is the descendant, that is the individual in the line that comes from Abram who will be the cause of blessing to the peoples throughout the world. But Abram is a little bit confused, obviously, about how this is going to happen, how this is going to play out. There's a little problem of Abram's relationship with Hagar. Ishmael comes about. Abram is struggling with, sort of thrashing around, trying to figure out how he's going to have a descendant when he and Sarah don't seem to be able to have any children. And then in Genesis 15, verses 7 through 21, there's a continuation of that promise when God says to Abram, Abram, and he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. And a little bit earlier, I should have referred to the passage before that in chapter 15, the verses before that, Abram is suggesting that somebody else should be his heir because he and Sarah don't seem to be able to have any children. So he's suggesting, how about Eliezer of Damascus? God is reminding him that he will have an heir that will come from his own body, so to speak. And it was in response to that, it was in response to God's reminder of what he was going to do in bringing about a descendant, that in Genesis 15, verse 6, we're told, then Abram believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Well, again, that is an account of what it means to respond in faith, to respond in belief to what God has said, to what God's doing. Well, then he goes on, and he fills out the promise a little bit further, talking about the land that they're going to possess, and there's the account of Abram trying to understand what that means. And later on in that passage, and I got this understanding from Walter Kaiser many years ago, later on in that passage, there's the account of when God tells Abram to bring several animals, ram, a heifer, turtle dove, goat, all sorts of animals, to bring those animals and prepare them for a sacrifice. And what happens, and it's my understanding that this was a common ritual that was part of the Eastern tradition at that time, what happened was Abram prepared the animals and he split the animals. They were killed and then their bodies were split in two. They were set in a line next to each other, and then the ritual or the tradition at that time was that both of the parties who were involved in this covenant, when two people came together and made a covenant, if you do this, I will do this, well, both of the parties to that covenant would walk between the sacrificed animals in order to illustrate, basically, this is what should happen to me. I should be sacrificed if I don't keep my part of the covenant. That was the Eastern tradition for a covenant ceremony like that. Well, in this case in Genesis chapter 15, what happens is that Abram prepares the sacrifice, and then what happens is Abram falls asleep, and in his sleep, in his dream, it is God alone in the form of an oven, a smoking oven, a flaming torch. It is God alone who walks between the pieces. Well, that, my understanding is, that is a picture of the fact that God's promises, God's plan is a unilateral plan. He does not, the fulfillment of his plan does not depend on our response. It doesn't depend on our doing something that holds up our end of the bargain. Rather, it is all about what God has promised to do. I'm going to jump down quite a bit later in the Old Testament. If you were to go to the book of Job, and I'm going to mention this just briefly, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Moses, and then we'll be done here. There's a passage in the book of Job, and sometime it'd be great fun to spend more time just going through the entire book of Job, because it is a fascinating account of one man's experience who God considers to be blameless and upright. Job is characterized as being blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. And yet Job goes through hell. I mean, he goes through the most horrendous experiences and circumstances because God has called Satan's attention to Job and then given Satan a free hand in doing what he wants to with Job as long as he doesn't take Job's life. Well, Job goes through all this misery. Then he has three friends come along who are there to comfort him. They're referred to as Job's comforters. And what's interesting about the book of Job, and you got to read it in detail if you haven't before, is that Job's comforters speak the same things about God that most of the church today is saying about God. They're the same things about God that we would very commonly say about God. They're very reasonable observations about who God is and about how God behaves. The problem is that God doesn't fit into any box like that that we prepare for him. So the three friends, while they're speaking things that seem to be reasonable, they do not, in fact, express truly who God is. And Job, in this case, there's a phrase in Job chapter 19, verses 25 through 27, that to me are Job's expression of what it means to have faith. In Job chapter 19, 25 through 27, he says, "As for me," he says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me." Well, that's Job's expression of faith. Job is in the midst of the horrible things that he's going through, with no good earthly reason to believe, Job expresses belief in who God is. "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God." That's an expression of Job's faith in God. And at the very end of Job chapter 42, verse 7, God has come along by this time in Job, and he's expressed who he is to Job, and he has given a much better picture of who he is. God never explains why he has done what he's done, but he gives a much better picture of who he is. And at that point, God says to Job's three friends, there's this interesting phrase, he says to to Job's three friends, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends," he was speaking to Eliphaz and to his two friends, "my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And that is, I'm not going to go on and talk about Moses. I'm going to end with that, because that's, I think, the critical thing for us to be thinking about as we deal with what the faith is all about. And that is that shot through our Christian culture today are discussions of what faith is all about, discussions of what the gospel is all about, that are not accurate. And there are many in the church today who are going to hear the same words that God spoke to Eliphaz and to his two friends when he says to them, "My wrath is kindled against you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And my hope, my desire for us, and my belief, as I have been a part of this group for some time now, over the last several years, my understanding is that it is our goal, it is our desire, simply and plainly, to understand simply who God is, not with all the trappings, not with all the extra theological formulations or theological systems or systematic theologies that go along with it, but to understand simply, plainly, from a biblical perspective, who is God and how is it that he's dealing with humans today, with us in our humanity and in our sinfulness. Well, with that, I'm going to wrap up and just take a few minutes for questions if you have any, and then we're done for the day.
Morning.
Morning, Logan.
Question in verse 6 of Hebrews. where it says, without faith it's impossible to please, for he who comes to God must believe that he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a New American Standard that is in italics. It's italicized, meaning it's not there. He is a rewarder of those who seek him. Is it possible that the language there is saying those who come to God must believe that he is? He is a rewarder of those who diligently search him. That is, in fact, he is saying there is one essential belief, and that is God's response to that essential belief.
I'd need to pull out my Greek New Testament. I don't think so. I think, and maybe somebody else here has it open. I think that there are two separate phrases there, and that is another, if we had gotten into a discussion about Moses, if we had gotten into a discussion of some of Jesus' words, I'm going to just give it to you real briefly. In Exodus chapter 3 and 4, when God calls Moses, the very first thing that he says to Moses, he starts off by saying to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then a few verses later, when Moses is resistant to going back to Egypt, when Moses just plain doesn't want to go.
Right.
And when he first says to God, well, who am I that I should go? God says, it doesn't matter, I'll go with you. So then he asks the question, well, who are you? Well, in my mind, God's response to that is a central understanding of what the gospel is all about throughout the rest of the scriptures. When he says, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, when he says, you ask who I am that I am. Tell them that I am sent you. So I link that to this passage in Hebrews 11, verse 6, where God is saying that by itself is sort of a foundation of what we believe, that I am. God speaking of himself says, I am. And that's where belief starts. That's the beginning of it. So to answer your question, in verse 6, I think it's talking about two separate things. One is simply the I am. And then the other is that as a result of that, there's a response that we have in seeking him with an understanding that he rewards those of us who seek him.
And the reason I ask the question is because later it says all these people, all these faithful died not having received the promises.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, this has come up recently in our Thursday morning Bible study. Is it possible that the essential belief is that God is, regardless of what you get out of it?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely, that is true. If you're talking about what you get out of it here and now, but if you're talking about, but I think what this passage is saying and what Hebrews says, if you go down a little bit later in Hebrews 11, it talks about the same idea that they were waiting for what was going to happen and what they came to understand. And I don't know what the time frame was. It might be that they came to understand it after they died. What they came to understand was what they were waiting for was far off. It wasn't something that they were going to realize and enjoy and participate in this life. Rather, it was, yes, the fundamental understanding is God is. That's what we cling to. But there also then is an understanding of at some point, things are going to be made right. They're going to be made right with me. They're going to be made right in the world. I mean, at some point, life might be lousy now. At some point, life is going to be good. Not necessarily before I die, but yeah. If I understand what you're asking, the key understanding is that God is, and the rewards might very well not come in this life. They are going to come. That's what Hebrews is talking about. They were waiting for a city that was afar off, a country that was being prepared for them.
I think that fits well with what you said about Job's statement of faith, because in that passage that you read, he's believing that his Redeemer lives, mm-hmm. and he's certainly a clear example of someone who wasn't getting stuff now in that moment, mm-hmm. and yet he was willing to say, I know that that's going to be resolved,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like something about the flesh on his,
and,
I love that.
And from my flesh I'll see him, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, it's like, without his own skin on his body anymore, he is going to see God.
Yep.
So I think that really fits with what you're saying the passage in Hebrews.
Yeah, Job, I love the book of Job, because if you read through Job's comments as he's responding to his three friends, as he's responding to God, you know, people talk about the patience of Job. He lost it pretty early on. I mean, he did not maintain his patience throughout his response. He got mad at God. He railed against God. He accused God. He did all sorts of things. And yet, there in Job chapter 19, I know that my Redeemer lives. That's what Job, in my mind, was just clinging on to. That's, he was hanging on for dear life to the belief that his Redeemer lived. And that's what I think is... again, the essence of the gospel, that God is, and that God is a redeemer. Somebody else?
Job does see God, but I was kind of understanding that God told him to shut his damn mouth. And so I guess what I'm confused, I like your example, and I totally agree with your description of faith. I mean, but isn't part of the faith that Job missed out on is this idea that trying to use words that I'm unaccustomed to using. That you don't mess with God. Like, I mean, and as for the two friends, the one, Elihu, he seems not to be singled out as a bad advisor, and his message to Job, too, was shut your goddamn mouth. And so, that's what I'm getting a sense. Like, I love your description of faith, but isn't it, too, the faith of that we're the created beings, and God's going to put it down the way he's going to put it down?
You bet.
Okay.
Elihu was the fourth friend.
Yeah, Elihu, yeah.
He was not one of the three friends. And after the friends and Job have all had their discussions back and forth, God comes along, just the most unbelievable passages, God comes along and says, where were you? He doesn't say, I don't think, he doesn't so much say, shut your blanky blank mouth.
Yeah.
He says...
Well, Job says, I'll shut my own mouth.
Exactly. That's it, exactly. God talks about who he is, and God talks about... his character, what he has done, about his creativity. He talks about and basically paints a picture of, for Job, of this is who I am. Who are you? And you're exactly right. At that point, Job says, time for me to shut up because now I have a better picture of it. Job never gets any answers to the question. He never gets any answers to the questions of why these things happened. He simply gets a picture of who God is. And again, that gets back to the critical component. It's all about who is God, and then my response is to sit back and wait and believe in him.
Yeah. Well, and in so much as that, I mean, Job got the answer, which was, it's the way it is, because it's the way it is. I mean, I'm God. I mean, none of the specifics were dealt with, but the specifics of the reason why, you know, your life sucks is because I'm God, and I say it has to suck at this point. Like, I mean, give my, I mean... I find Elihu's critique of Job was that the very nature of your questions seemed to be rather silly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not one of those people that sees Job as the victor in so much that at least he escaped with his life. But I mean, he doesn't see his questions. The whole point is your questions are really stupid.
Like, yeah.
And so I love your description of faith in that. That it's us coming to terms with who God is, and God's going to be doing the work, because that's what I'm seeing in Job too. Because in the end, God puts the word down, and nobody's going to fight about that.
Yeah, Job blows it in many respects in his response. Elihu, I think, nails Job. Elihu is not one of the three friends. The three friends, I think, messed up again and again in their account of who God is and who Job is. I think Elihu is much more accurate, but then God doesn't say anything at all about Elihu's response. He simply talks about who he is. And in response to who he is, and that's the heart of what I'm trying to say, is that it's all about stepping back and seeing who God is. And as God paints a picture of this is who I am, Job's response is the same response that all of us should have. Like you said, it's, I'm quiet. Now you're God. I'm not. I understand more clearly. I repent in dust and in ashes, as Job says, before who God actually is and who he reveals himself to be.
I think it's kind of interesting that I think Elihu means he is God in Hebrew. So I wonder if this is another of God's incarnations of
you know, he put somebody down there who's his mouthpiece, a temporary mouthpiece in this case. I was wondering, I don't have a Bible right here, so I can't see it, but it all of a sudden occurred to me that when it says, he who comes to God must believe that he is and is a rewarder of those who seek him, I guess I've always heard that taught and thought that what it meant was these are the criteria that we use for, you know, this is how we, somebody who's truly saved believes, somebody who's a good guy, I guess, somebody who's going to make it. But I'm wondering if that's sort of the other way around, and I don't know if the text would work with this, but he might be saying the implication of coming to God. I mean, why would you come to a God that you didn't know existed? So the fact that you have come to God implies that you know he exists, and that why would you come to him if you thought he was going to slap you down? He would necessarily implies he'd be a rewarder of those who seek him. So maybe instead of having like two criteria there, we just have one, coming to God. If you come to God, that's what marks someone who belongs to God. Somebody who comes to God is not going to be, you know, by definition, they must believe he exists, and otherwise they wouldn't have anybody to go to if they didn't think he exists. And they must believe he's a rewarder of those who seek him, because it would make no sense for them to come to him unless they expected that there was, you know, some benefit to doing that. Would that work with the text, do you think? And do you think there's, you know, is that a substantially different understanding?
I don't think it is substantially different. I view all of this as part of the same cloth, and that is a lot of times people will suggest they'll try to separate the two, that somehow or other belief and how we respond or our behavior or our pursuit of God are two different things, and even suggest in some cases that we pursue God, that it is the pursuit of God or the seeking God that actually indicates that we believe or gives us belief or something like that. Well, in my mind, it's all part of the same cloth, and that is the God who has revealed himself is the God who opens our eyes to see that he is the same God that works in our life so that our lives are different as a result. None of it is me. It is all about what God is doing, and it all is, I mean, there's a seamless transition in the whole process. It isn't that I do this and then I believe and then I set about changing my life or anything like that. It's rather that God gives me belief, and then God prompts me to seek him and to pursue him. And it's all part of the same cloth there.
One other question about the form that they wanted you to fill out about your, you know, do you believe this? Do you agree to this? It seems to me the way that the organized church is set up, a lot of times you're in a situation where you want to hire a pastor, say you want to hire a teacher for your church, and there isn't anybody that you've already gotten to know, so you're trying to find a pastor. And somehow you want to get some idea of what this guy's like. Is he wise, or, you know, is he going to be a good pastor for you? So how, just out of curiosity, I agree that having a, you know, true false test or multiple choice test, you know, of your theology is probably not the way to do it. But how would you, if you were going to ask the person questions, what questions would you ask somebody applying to be a pastor or teacher in a church to determine, how would you determine if he would be good for that job?
Well, that's a tough one. In my mind, it really is not even so much about the questions that are asked and the correct answers to the questions. It's about the process that one goes through of giving the answer, and that is, is it a thoughtful, careful, well-reasoned explanation of what the scriptures have to say, or I am more wary of the one that just has the answers right on the tip of their tongue, for whom the answers come just as easily as opening a book and reading off the correct answer. In my mind, it is much more a matter of how is it that they're wrestling with the issue? How is it that they're struggling with the issue? And the one who struggles and the one who grapples with what the scriptures have to say is the one I'm far more interested in than the one who has all the answers. Because the one with all the answers, in my experience, all too often doesn't necessarily have the best answers. So, and with that, we're done. Thank you very much, and we'll see you later.